I'm going to start this up. I'll start just with a little bit of a welcome for a lot of people that may not have been on the first call. So these are the 30 on Thursday webinars that are presented by Mick Law. As I stated last week, 30 on Thursday webinars will be in addition to our regular scheduled client calls. Our plan is to produce on a frequent basis these short, focused, economically related topics germane to our industry. We will always send invite emails on Mondays, usually around 11 o'clock Central Time, prior to each Thursday webinar, and we'll also follow up with a reminder email the Wednesday before. Please note that the webinars will be in presentation mode only, so you will not have any audio capabilities. Questions you have can be submitted by clicking on the chat at the bottom of your screen or by email prior to or during the webinar. Finally, we will be recording each webinar and we'll provide access to the recordings via our website. Our first 30 on Thursday is up on our website as I am speaking. Today's webinar is titled The Five Major Real Estate Food Groups, The Current American Appetite, and features Alan Lincoln, Director of Real Estate at Kiewit, and also Mick Law's lead real estate underwriter. Note that we will leave approximately 10 minutes at the end of our discussion to answer as many submitted questions as time allows. So given the current COVID-19 pandemic, the various state and federal safer at home guidelines that are in place, as well as the government defining essential versus non-essential business, I introduce you to Alan Lincoln, who we will start with retail. And so Alan, give me your take on retail and how a buyer or current owner should maybe temper his or her operational expectations given the current economic situation we find ourselves in.
Well, sure, David. Thank you. Appreciate the invite as always, and appreciate the introduction as well. You know, I think about asset classes, and I've spent a lot of time reading over the last couple of weeks and kind of learning about what's happening in the market. I think a lot of data is still to come out. So some of this is speculation, some of it's hearsay, but I think a majority of it will eventually pan out. So in the retail world, I kind of classify retailers in three different categories right now, and I'll just use in the black, in the red, and then I've got retailers that I'd call in the gray zone or somewhere in the middle. So in the black, you've got essential retailers throughout the country that are essentially unimpacted by anything to do with COVID-19. These are grocery stores, gas stores, pharmacy, pet supply stores, anything that's essential to that has been deemed an essential business, which the CDC has produced a number of lists on. We won't need to go into more detail on that. But anything that that's deemed an essential business, they actually may see a positive uptick as consumers move to those stores for non-essential goods as well. So instead of buying, you might have bought your toothpaste at Target now, and you may be making a run to a local grocery store, and you're already there and you don't want to go out and make another trip. And so you go ahead and purchase your toothpaste there instead of going someplace else. So you can think of 100 other examples, but just those sorts of things. I think they may actually see a positive uptick from an underwriting standpoint or from an economic standpoint. They're essentially unimpacted. They've got a ready labor supply now with unemployment obviously skyrocketing throughout a number of industries. They've got a ready labor supply, and they've got a steady client list. Next, I would call it, I guess I'll move down the spectrum, what's called retailers that are in the gray zone. These are your Dollar Generals. This is Lowe's. This is Home Depot. These are farm and agricultural supply stores. Really kind of depends upon the state and where you're at. Automotive dealerships, really kind of depends upon the state. The three of us are in Nebraska. Grant, David, and myself are in Nebraska, and there's essentially no impact to a lot of those types of businesses. But in certain states, there certainly are. In Michigan, for example, as far as I know, you can't walk into a Home Depot and buy lumber and buy building materials and things like that, even though folks probably have a lot of time on their hands to do some home improvement projects. They can't do them right now. So the numbers that you have to come in for those, it really kind of depends upon local or national regulations, laws, restrictions. But when those do come in, I think we'll see, dine-in restaurants, they're almost universally closed, but the drive-through traffic is up. I think you'll see a decreased number of people at the stores just given the risk of being out and about and being exposed. And I think states where the they're hardest hit or where they're most impacted, obviously their sales are going to be decreased significantly. But I don't think there'll be that great of an impact. I mean, no. It's not like Dollar General or Lowe's or Home Depot. You know, none of them are going to close or go out of business or that sort of thing. I think those businesses are all fine. They're just going to weather the storm. Then you've got retailers that I would say are in the red and they're struggling. These are non-essential retailers. They're mom and pop. They're clothing. They're jewelry. They're bookstores. They're small restaurants and strip centers. They're movie theaters, for example, are almost universally closed throughout the nation. These retailers are absolutely unable to pay their rent over the next 30 to 60 to 90 days. Banks are working actively, all lenders are working actively with their clients to provide relief. But when these tenants are not paying rent, it obviously goes to the underlying fundamentals of strip center or strip center retail, or what does it mean to be a strip or neighborhood strip center as opposed to an anchored strip center. If the center has got some sort of anchor in it, I think you're probably in good shape. But if it's not, you need to be working with a lender, working with local banks to figure out some sort of financing alternatives. From an underwriting standpoint, just generally across these broad categories, I think underwriting needs to reflect much higher vacancies on the retailers that are in the red, needs to reflect higher bad debt expense, and it needs to reflect lower rents at these strip centers. Demand is going to fall, I think, pretty dramatically over the next 60 to 90 days. So the next couple of quarters, I think you're going to be pretty rough with this asset class and going to have a hard time holding on to a lot of mom and pop businesses that have been impacted by this. As far as the gray zone, I think, again, little or no impact, but underwriting may need to affect some added risk for those retailers who are, who quite had questionable balance sheets before. I can't think of a great example off the top of my head, but they're out there. Certainly triple net leased retailers that had a balance sheet that was, somewhat in worse shape than investment grade. And then you've got focus on the fundamentals again for restaurant retailers or any of those gray zone retailers.
Okay, we'll move on to an asset class that's kind of a little bit, finds itself in a little bit more unique situation. That's hospitality. Give me a little bit of your thoughts on hospitality and what you think the speed bumps they might find themselves running into over the next 30, 60, 90 days.
Absolutely. And again, I'm making general comments. This may or may not apply specifically to the Embassy Suites that's just down the road from you. But I guess in general, you've got a lot of states like Nevada, which have completely closed hotels for 30 to 60 days. You know, MGM, Caesars, all those hotels are closed, and not that any of those are going to be owned. Of course, those companies own all their own hotels, but certainly has an impact on the tourism industry and the hotel industry in that market as well is taking a bad beating. Either way, no matter what happens with travel, whether they're deemed essential, some states have classified them essential, some states have said they're non-essential. If you're in North Dakota, you can probably stay at any hotel you want to. If you're in Las Vegas, you probably can't stay at any hotel. Either way, it's suspected that nationally travel will fall by as much as 50% in 2020 as compared to 2019. Business travelers are off the road. Most Fortune 500 firms I look at or I talk to are only offering essential travel only. So if you absolutely have to go somewhere, that's fine. Maybe you can do so, but if it's not essential or if it doesn't have to be done, they're not allowing it at all, and probably won't for another 6 months. This is an extended period of time and an extended period of stress. And again, travel is suspected that it'll fall by much as 50%. It creates a tremendous problem for the hospitality industry. I think the underwriting at the asset level needs to reflect a period of higher vacancy and lower ADR clearly for the next 60 to 90 days, maybe for the next 6 months. Over the long term, it really depends upon what shape the economy. We talk a lot about the shape of the economy and what kind of shape of a correction we have, whether it's U-shaped or V-shaped or W-shaped. I've heard all arguments under the sun for different types of economic trends here over the next 6 to 12 months. Either way, this travel issue is likely to exist into the summer and the fall of 2020 as well. I think by 2021, we're probably off and running again and things resume at normal, perhaps with slightly lower ADRs and slightly lower occupancies. I don't think it's going to be a dramatic impact, but certainly over the next 60 to 90 days, we had to focus on just kind of staying afloat.
What about you start comparing some of the different classes of hotels, right? So you talk about full service versus limited or select service. If in 2 weeks everything opens up, I mean, do you anticipate some of these select service hotels having a little bit easier of a bump to get over than, for instance, full service, which you might have a lot of these groups deciding we're just not going to do conferences for the next 6 or 8 months? Meaning,
yeah, I think you're
a good percentage of the income, I think, on some of these full service come from their full service hotel experience.
You are exactly correct. On any hotel, a full service hotel that we see, the food and beverage revenue or conference revenue can make up as much as 25% of the hotel's overall revenue. It makes up a fairly significant amount of the hotel expense as well, but it can make up a pretty substantial amount of the revenue. So the revenue models for those hotels are going to be dramatically different in 2020 than they were as opposed to 2019 or probably again in 2021 as well. That select service is what businesses return to first. This is what Fortune 500 firms, how their travelers move throughout the nation. This is a Hampton Inn and Suites, for example, or a Town Place Inn and Suites, whatever the case may be. Those hotels are the first ones that come back online. They're the first ones that recover, and they're the first ones that gain back those business travelers. The luxury hotels are by far the ones that take the longest time to come back to full circle and get back to where they were again.
Okay, how about office?
Office is the Wild West right now. I spend most of my time in office, as I've talked about at our conference and a number of calls in the past. Office is where I spend most of my time right now. And I've been on a lot of panels recently. Yesterday I was on a panel, and director of facilities for Edward Jones was on the panel. Had a director of facilities for Cushman Wakefield was on the panel, and we were talking about, you know, what happens to this thing after it's all said and done, and after we get through. Okay, we know we have this interim period where we've got to do all these different types of measures, maybe staggering our workforce, or maybe work from home, or maybe we bring back non-essential employees all over. But after it's all over, what does that mean? And that's really the question for office right now. Office tenants, I think, are asking for relief right now. I don't know that the majority of them probably don't need relief right now. They have maybe not experienced the pain. If you have a law firm, for example, in a multi-tenant building, just use us for an example. If you got a law firm, most of their clients are professional clients, and they're still open and they're still operating. And so things are kind of still coming through the door. They may not have been coming through the door at the same rate they were before, but they're not experiencing the pain that a mom and pop restaurant, for example, has endured in just the immediate closure of their doors. So then you shift to, okay, well, what happens after we get through this, and what does that mean for office? Do we need less office? Do we need more office? And the panel was divided yesterday, and I think people are trying to decide, well, are more people going to work from home? Well, that's fine if more people work from home, but does everybody still need an individual workspace? If I'm in a shared office and I'm in a hoteling type model, and I come in and say, okay, I'm going to work from home 2 days a week, and my colleague is going to work from through at home 3 days a week, and so now all of a sudden we can share a workspace. That all works fine until you apply it on a mass scale, and all of a sudden the person who works Monday, Wednesday, Friday, and I go to sit down in their workstation on Tuesday and Thursday, I don't know who that person is. And even if I know who that person is, I don't feel comfortable enough to sit down in their workspace without some kind of deep sanitization. And that deep sanitization doesn't come without a cost. The question is, does that cost? At what point does that cost outweigh the real estate cost of making all these modifications and leasing less or more space and rearranging the workspaces? All those sorts of things start to have a ripple effect and really lead you to question whether we are going to need more or less office. And the right answer is probably somewhere in between. Maybe nothing changes about this at all. Maybe we have a greater population of people that work from home for the sake of staying safe and staying healthy, but when they come into the office, they have the same workspace they had before. I think a few things are certain at the moment. One, conference rooms that had a 10-person or 12-person capacity no longer have that same capacity anymore. They only have a 5 or 6-person capacity, maybe it's half of what it was, just to maintain those social distancing type guidelines. You know, cafeterias, cafes, workspaces, work cafes, all these type of collaborative spaces that have been prevalently used in colleges, universities, and then have crept their way into Fortune 500 firms in corporate America are now clearly going to change. There's got to be a dramatic change to those, at least on the short term, in terms of their usage. And if they have to change and remain the same type of spaces, they're just going to occupy a bigger footprint. So again, it's a wild west right now. I think underwriting just has to wait and see what trends emerge. The real impact is probably not known for years. It's probably a Gensler or an HGR, some major architecture firms that start to put out these studies that what kind of impact does it have? What's the science behind occupancy and how does it really affect office usage? And then we wait to see what some major players do in the industry. That's probably when we start to understand what trends emerge. It's years before we know the true impact upon the modern office. And then, as we haven't done a lot of work in multi-tenant office, in terms of multi-tenant office, I think you could be in a situation where one tenant's growing, but another shrinking for the very same reasons. And so you end up with a net impact of potentially nothing by the time it's all sorted out. So instability in the short term, that's the name of the game, especially if you've got some smaller tenants in a multi-tenant office, there's some instability there. If you're with a Fortune 500 firm, you probably ride out the storm. They may be asking for something that they don't particularly need or particularly have reason to ask for at the moment, but it's a wild west. We just have to wait till the trends appear and see what kind of data supports the conclusions that are floating around.
Alan, we did have a little chat from Mr. Barrett. He just wanted to know that he had recently heard that Morgan Stanley CEO had indicated that their office footprint is expected to shrink significantly with recent experience of work from home scenarios. Is that something that you have any comment as it relates to that? Or you think that's, I mean, if Morgan Stanley's thinking that, we might have a lot of these financial institutions deciding to do the same, which could have a big impact on a lot of the big cities that are in the financial industry. What do you think?
Agreed. Doesn't surprise me from a financial services firm, though. I mean, they were headed that direction anyway. If anything, they just needed a push. They were already headed. If you look at like an Edward Jones or a Morgan Stanley or a TD Ameritrade, they were already headed towards that model. TD has been a company that in Omaha has had a work from home platform for probably the last 4 to 5 years. And lots of their employees do hoteling and things like that. So it doesn't surprise me that a Morgan Stanley would come out and say, hey, hallelujah, it's a win. We've mastered this. We figured it out and we're able to work from home. But I think a lot of other firms are going to struggle for the very same reasons that they are going to succeed with it. If you weren't already headed that way, this may have tested technology to its breaking point. This may have tested the workforce to a point in which they can't develop the same type of collaboration and cohesive solutions. Again, for folks who do individual work or who have measurable productive kind of standards to reach, it wouldn't surprise me that it's easy to work from home. But if you're in a more difficult industry, if you're in a construction engineering, just to use an example, it's probably a little difficult to say, okay, this is going to dramatically change our workforce and we're going to work from home.
Okay, good. Let's move on to industrial. That might be one shining light of an industry or an asset class. Give me your thoughts on industrial.
Well, you read about the walkouts in Amazon, and it seems like there is trouble brewing in the industrial sector, but I can tell you that it's anything but the truth. Industrial may be the greatest winner out of this entire thing. They may be the only winner in the short term, if there is a true winner out of this COVID-19 change. Online learning platforms are being tested like never before, but they're also succeeding with greater success than they could have imagined. People are having their groceries delivered and everything under the sun. And although I think you hear people say, oh, my Amazon order didn't arrive in 24 hours like it used to. It took, 3 days or something else. I managing the expectations in the short term, I think the industrial sector in general is going to benefit from this whole thing. The online is going to get the greatest push it's probably gotten in the past 20 years. And as a result, those online platforms, those industrial space demand is only going to grow for any of those industrial giants. When the industrial giants move out of the smaller spaces, new startups can move into those. And it's just sort of the trickle up effect of industrial that we've seen over the past 5 years, probably accelerated. The one drawback in that whole thing, maybe this, some of the smaller startups who are in older industrial flex type space, functionally obsolescent space. I talk about that from time to time in my underwriting presentations about sort of a sub asset class of industrial that may be struggling. But in terms of high bay industrial distribution or the bulk of industrial product that's out there, Inland Empire type industrial product, I think it's only up from here for that entire asset class. The underwriting should reflect stable strength and growth and occupancy and in rental rates over the next couple of years, barring some sort of economic dip that folks are not foreseeing right now. Industrial just continues to grow.
Okay, and then the last of the five major food groups is also the one that speaks for about 60% of the 1031 product, and that's multifamily. Give me your thoughts on multifamily going forward.
Absolutely. So I think a couple thoughts about multifamily and the way that it's going to change. First of all, I don't know that anything about COVID or anything about the current economic situation changes that people need a place to live. It's an essential service. What it does probably change is people's ability to pay for that place to live. However, if it does so, it does so in a temporary format only. I think from a standpoint of the type of projects we're looking at right now, and you're right, David, we look at a lot of multifamily projects, but I think it's probably a short-term period in here where we're reflecting higher bad debt expense and maybe a blip in occupancy. Right now, 1 in 10 Americans are out of work. And if you extrapolate that, would reflect, you know, if you took 3 months of 10% bad debt expense, maybe that's a good starting point for every multifamily project to say, what is our true downside of this thing? I think most people think we'll be back to work in the next 90 days, although there's some uncertainty about that. But I think the bulk of certainly governors, if not on the national political scene, reflecting a startup in the economy in the next 90 days. And so if it does, we're probably talking about reflecting 3 months of 10 to 15% bad debt expense for those folks who are out of work. You could argue that multifamily living is going to hit the income class or the type of employee who is most out of work right now. I don't know that that's the case, particularly for the products we look at, though. We're looking at so much Class A development anymore and so many really nice apartment communities. It's not just restaurant and retail workers who are located at this. In fact, it's maybe not those type of employees at all. So maybe the bad debt expense doesn't even change if you've got a class AA in suburban Chicago, just for example. So again, I think a few move back in with mom and dad, but if anything, multifamily renters likely stay put. Deal flow has slowed down on single family housing. Loans have slowed down substantially. Home buying has slowed down substantially. It probably delays the purchase of a home. If you're in the middle of buying a home, right in the midst of this thing, you might have scrapped your plans. You might have decided to bail out on that. And so you might find folks staying around multifamily properties a little bit longer than anticipated. Maybe some even get a short-term bump in occupancy out of that. I could see that going either way. At any rate, I think the downside risk is some increased bad debt, maybe a little bit of increased occupancy, or maybe a little bit of increased vacancy just in the short term.
Yeah, I think you're right on when you start talking about a lot of the product we're seeing in the Class A multifamily space. I mean, really, it goes back to your whole location, location, location idea, right? I mean, if you have a Class A, it's a prime facility, but it happens to be in Orlando, you may very well have a good percentage of your renters that, although are making a decent living, are in the service space where maybe they're furloughed now at Disney, and now they may no longer have the same income coming in. But whether or not they decide that means they're going to move out and move in with mom and dad, I don't know. I would like to think that the vast majority of them would like to continue living in a place that they want to live. And it goes to the whole adage where rent may be the last thing that people don't pay. And I think if that is the case, maybe we can get through this in 60 to 90 days, where by the time I think these individuals are really thinking about having to cut loose from a more expensive apartment, maybe they're back, back at work. I guess that's...
Yeah, you're gonna drop your cable or internet service down. You're gonna drop your gym membership, and you're gonna drop your Starbucks habit long before you stop making your rent payment. And I know that on average Americans don't have a whole lot of savings, but I'm with you. If you're a furloughed Disney worker right now, you're certainly thinking, I'm going back to work in 90 days. I just got to get through this interim period. A lot of multifamily owners are being very proactive about that situation, approaching it from a very practical standpoint and working with tenants to extend out leases, for example. So if you've got, you need 3 months worth of rent relief, that's fine. Let's sign a new 18-month lease or something that tags that term on the backside. So maybe you get a little bit more stable occupant on that deal. Maybe you buy some brand loyalty in doing so. In fact, you probably do buy some brand loyalty in doing so. And, as long as we're understanding that, it's a short-term thing and that does what the experts think it's going to do. I think we're back on track in 90 days and you probably have a more stable base in the end of the day.
Well, we have a couple more minutes, so maybe we'll just venture into two other asset classes because I know we do see a lot of it in the 1031 space, and that's student housing and self-storage. Can you give maybe just a little snippet of what you think might be happening in those two asset classes, at least over the next, maybe we'll just go through 2020. I don't know. That might be a good starting point.
Yeah, I actually just saw in my email inbox this morning a special report from Marcus and Millichap that was talking about self-storage and self-storage nationwide presenting excellent fundamentals coming into April. So on 1 April, the early indications are that the rent statistics and the occupancy statistics are very strong. Of course, that's when the office and the retail world really started to feel the pain was those April 1 rents. A lot of tenants made their payment on March 1st, but on April 1 was the time which they said that they can't. So the report was basically, I've yet to kind of read the whole thing. I skimmed it as I was kind of preparing for this call, but the report's more or less saying that the early indications from the from April occupancy and rent statistics are good, and that self-storage is well prepared to weather that storm, that folks need that storage. It was a lifestyle type decision to take on storage in the first place. And so, you're not going to throw out your bike and all of your college textbooks and whatever else just because, you got furloughed for 30 days. So I think self-storage probably fares well for many of the same reasons that the asset class has been trending and ticking up over the past couple of years. It's pretty stable. Student housing, on the other hand, is a difficult one for me. Most universities have moved to online platforms. Although if you're an independent 21-year-old student who is living in a student housing type facility, I'm not sure moving in with mom and dad or moving back in with mom and dad is what you've done. I think there are a fair proportion of students who are probably back living home with mom and dad just for the safety, the security, the whole thing. But there's certainly that idea that was a permanent living spot. Maybe they've been there a year or 2 years, or certainly a longer term commitment to them when they signed up to that lease. In addition, most of those student housing leases are guaranteed by mom and dad. I mean, they usually don't sign them without some sort of a guarantee, even though it's a low, if you've got a four bedroom, split four ways at $450 a month per individual, it's not a huge monthly commitment, but yet they've been smart. The industry has trended towards requiring guarantees on those leases for some time. So you probably have a little bit of teeth in that and getting the rent paid. And so far, probably not feeling the pain as well. Where it's going to get really interesting for student housing is next fall and what happens with universities as they move back into classroom space. I've heard universities say, oh, we're going to move more to online education. I've heard universities say, we absolutely can't wait to get students back in class because that's where they learn best. That one could go either way for me. And what happens in the fall is going to be the indicator for many, many years to come. Because if the online learning worked at any point in time, it had to either succeed or fail in this 30 to 60 day period, particularly for upperclassmen who are trying to get those degrees and move on and move into the next phase of life. So next fall is when we find out where the rubber meets the road on that. Student housing is probably okay in the short term.
Just a quick question from one of the guests. Any thoughts on wireless infrastructure and or data centers?
No, not necessarily. I don't think they probably see a whole lot of impact as well. I think and we don't see a whole lot of that in our business, but certainly there are data centers out there that are trended and for sale. If anything, there's probably a stronger need for those services than there ever was before as folks test their internet capabilities. But I don't see there being a heck of a lot of impact. Those, most of them are long-term leases. They're stable and they're in place with institutions that are probably, their business model hasn't taken much of a hit or seen much of a decline in service. If anything, they've probably seen an uptick in service. So I just don't see there being a whole lot of impact to those particular asset classes.
Okay. Well, with that, we're at about our 30-minute period of time, which is what we try to keep these at, so you guys can get back to living your lives outside of listening to us talk. One reminder I do want to mention, and that is we do a MIC podcast as well. Our part one on energy is up on our website as we speak. And that was with guest Dan Steffens. And the second, or part two of energy, was actually recorded this morning and should be available for your listening in the next day or so. And that, once again, is on our website under resources. And that was with Steve Burr of BCS Energy Services. He was along with Brad Updike on that part two on energy. So with that, I'll let you guys get back to life as is. And I appreciate your time spending it with us. It's very important that we continue to try to provide some outlets for information to all of you as we deal with the current economic upheaval. So with that, I'll let you guys go. And I appreciate everything.
Thanks, David.